So here we go. It is officially recording now. Great. All right. So let me get the PowerPoint going. If there's ever a presentation I needed a PowerPoint on, it's certainly this one. Teaching archaeology in the Bible is like teaching art history without pictures. You know, you kind of need to have pictures. Okay. There we go. All right, so, yes, it's working. Fantastic. All right, so let's think a little bit about this. You cannot prove Christianity. You can't prove Jesus raised from the dead from history and archaeology. Remember I talked about some aspects of Christian evidence basically can be used as offensive weapons to really create faith and bring people to Jesus. That would certainly include the messianic prophecies we looked at yesterday. History and archaeology principally is a defensive kind of apologetic in that basically we can show that that history is consistent with the Bible. And a lot of people say, you know, the Bible's full of a bunch of stories and fables and, you know, David never lived and, you know, Israel never left Egypt. Who's Abraham? And all these kind of stuff. And so we can present hard evidence. In this case, it is hard evidence to show that the Bible is, in fact, reliable as history. All right, so we have to give a little bit of background here. Let's think about some of the periods, in history. This is the time of the patriarchs. Where would the Bible be looking? What part of the world would the Bible be looking at during the time of the patriarchs? I'm talking about Abraham, Isaac, Noah, these people.
Mesopotamia,
that's correct. So if the Bible has accurate history and culture and all that, then the cultural milieu, big fancy word, the cultural background of Genesis should be Mesopotamia in the third millennium and early second millennium BC. And by the way, that's exactly what it is. Okay? And then there's the period of the slavery and the Exodus. And what should be the cultural setting of that period of history as we read the Bible? Egypt, obviously. So the culture that we reflected, the traditions you'd see, the background should be Egyptian. See, you have to understand that most scholars, they may be so smart, but they just have this crazy idea that say, for example, you know, say Exodus was written around 500 BC. And it had no connection whatsoever or virtually none to actual events in the ancient past. All right, so we could ask, all right, fine, what we see in Genesis, is this consistent with what we know culturally about Palestine, 500 BC, or is it more similar to culture what we know, even from other archaeological discoveries, about Mesopotamia in 2000 BC? And by the way, the answer comes up positive on the side of the Bible, I'll tell you right now. And then you have the time of the judges, the time of the United Kingdom, and the time of the divided kingdom. All right, the destruction of the southern kingdom, the destruction of the northern kingdom, the destruction of the southern kingdom, and then the exile being brought into Babylon and Assyria, being brought back into the promised land, the rebuilding of the temple, the time of Jeremiah, rebuilding of Jerusalem. When in that whole range of time would you start to see actual physical objects that might reflect things found in the Bible? Think about it. When would you reasonably expect, if the Bible is an accurate record, to find actual physical remains reflecting directly things described in the Bible?
The United Kingdom?
Right, during the period of the United Kingdom. So we would not expect to find this big monument from the time of the patriarchs to Abraham because there were none. And by the way, what we find exactly matches what you'd expect, common sense. Okay, we're not going to find huge settlements in Egypt of the Hebrews. What do you think they left behind? You know, the lowest quality huts. They were living in slavery. All right, so it just so happens that what we expect and we're going to see is what we end up seeing. So when we look back to the time, let's say, of the patriarchs, the best we could really hope for is some interesting clues and hints that what we find in Genesis just so happens to agree with things that were going on culturally at that time in that place, which Jewish people 1,500 years later wouldn't know anything about. You have to understand, when these skeptics say the Old Testament was written, it's 1,500 years removed from Abraham. What was happening here 1,500 years ago here in Missouri? You know, think about it. I mean, Columbus, that's 600 years ago. Less than that. All right, that's a long time. All right, so anyway, let's just give you kind of an introduction here. Let's see here. Oops, what happened? It seemed to skip something. No, I guess not. It's in a different order than the one I have is the problem. It's all right. Doesn't matter. Let me see what it actually has as the order. Okay. So this one is missing. That's fine. What should be up there is a picture of Ur. It's the ziggurat in Ur. And the Bible describes Abraham starting out in this very, very wealthy city with, you know, a lot of wealth. In fact, Ur has been excavated. In fact, it was the largest city, certainly in Mesopotamia, possibly in the world at that time. Then according to the book of Genesis, Abraham went to the city Haran. And Haran is the way it's described, is kind of, it's a smaller city out in the hinterlands or something like that. Well, it just so happens that Haran has also been discovered and it's been excavated. And it's interesting. Haran was destroyed roughly 1800 BC. All right? So let's accept the skeptic's idea, which is that Genesis was written around 500 BC or so. All right, knowledge of that city had disappeared 1,300 years before. How many people would have even heard of the city of Haran? I'd say probably nobody. Yeah. All right, that's just a little detail. Now, and then there's the Ebla tablets. So let me talk about the Ebla tablets. These are found in the city of Ebla. Ebla would be in Syria today, northeast Syria. And they found something like 30,000 tablets in cuneiform. Anyway, it's not a detailed record of Abraham's wanderings because he was just some guy. But it's interesting. Some of the names found on the Ebla tablets include Nahor. All right. Terug, Abraham, and Sarai. Now, do you think that Nahor was a common name 500 B.C. in Canaan? All right. Let's imagine... You found a letter that was written in 1890. And it was from, Jennifer to Jessica. You go, no, trust me. If it said, Gertrude was writing a letter to Harold in 1890, all right, that would work, okay? But, you know, so again, it's a small thing. But the fact is that the names of the characters that are in Genesis, in the early part of Genesis, are those of names that were used roughly 2000 BC in Mesopotamia. And, you know, these were not names that were known by anybody 1500 years later. Does this prove that the Bible is inspired by God and all that's in the Bible is accurate? No, we're creating a picture here. There's another interesting story. It's the story involving Jacob and Laban. It's interesting. Jacob, you know, he got the not quite so beautiful woman first, so he had to work another 8 years. And then he got the one he wanted. He was kind of worldly in that way. And then, he took off, and Laban chased him down. And he chased him down to get what? To get the household idols. He wasn't trying to get Rachel back. He wasn't trying to get Leah back. He was trying to get the household idols back. Well, that's interesting. But then they found an inscription in Mesopotamia that said, whoever has the household idols inherits the wealth from the father. Ah, okay. Was that a tradition in Palestine in 500 BC? No. In fact, would somebody living in Palestine in 500 BC had even the foggiest idea that would even be something you'd even think about putting into a story? So again, like I said, The cultural context of Genesis is Mesopotamia, 2000 BC. Does that prove that Abraham lived? I don't think we'll ever find, a cave somewhere Abraham lived here. And if it did, we already know that Abraham was a common name back then, so that wouldn't really tell us anything. So what we have is information consistent with the Bible, and it's all we could even reasonably expect to find. Okay, next here. Okay, let's talk about the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, in Genesis 14, it describes a league of five cities that hooked up with Abraham and Lot and fought a battle against Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam. And these five cities were in the valley around what we'd call the Dead Sea. It's interesting. When Abraham and Lot came to the up in the hill country, Lot said, "I'll take the awesome farmland down by the Dead Sea, and you get the lousy farmland up there in the hills." Now, I was at the Dead Sea this summer, and I'm telling you, it's not a great place. It is as desolate as you could possibly imagine. It's like, seriously? So according to the Bible, it had intense farming? 2000 B.C.? In fact, almost no archaeological excavations had been done around the Dead Sea because people figured, why even bother? But then, I don't know, about 20, 25 years ago, an archaeologist thought, well, you know, let's just see what we find. Guess how many cities they found? Five. Guess when all five cities were destroyed? About 2,100 years ago. All of them destroyed by fire. Now, cities being destroyed by fire, that's not like a huge thing in archaeology. That's kind of how they were destroyed. But all five destroyed by fire at the same time and never occupied again. In fact, the whole area was never occupied again. They had intense farming, and it wasn't because it rained there a lot. It did not. It was a little bit wetter. They had these wadis up there. Again, this doesn't work, but you can kind of see those little streams. And I was flying over Peru a couple years ago, and you're flying over the western part of Peru, and it's desolate. It's unbelievably desolate, except where these little rivers come down from the mountains. And they had intense irrigation and farming there. Interestingly, the largest city is the one in the north. almost certainly, it's called Bab Ed-Dra, and almost certainly was Sodom. They found 3 feet thick ashes on that city. And interestingly, about a half mile out beside the city, east of the city, there was a graveyard with these little wooden structures, apparently. And the evidence was they burned from the top to the bottom. I think about that. When you burn stuff down, generally, do you burn it from the top to the bottom or the bottom to the top? Bottom to the top. Now, I don't want to, remember I said yesterday, don't try to get more out of it than you have. I don't want to call this proof that fire and brimstone fell from the sky. I'm not going to call that proof. I'm just going to kind of go, wow, that's sort of cool, and leave it at that. I think that's probably what we should do with that. All right, there you go. Bab Ed-Dra, probably that was Sodom. We can't say for sure. Anyway, okay, great. Here are some of the actual ruins of what was Sodom. Not a lot to see today, but then again, it's been 4,000 years, so that shouldn't be too terrifically surprising. All right, here's another one. So let's go forward a little bit to the time of the Exodus. And you have to understand, these archaeologists, most of them, the whole idea that the Jews were ever in Egypt, obviously they were a polytheistic tribe that originated somewhere in the desert east of Palestine, and all this stuff. Trust me, this is what they'll say. And, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. We can't prove that Israel was enslaved in Egypt. We simply can't do that. There's just not the evidence there. And if you want to say that there was, okay, go ahead and say that. But then you know, you're really pushing it there. All right. Good. The PowerPoint I have here is in a different order. That's why I'm getting a little confused here. That's right. All right. In the city of Tel El Amarna, they found a number of tablets. And these are called the Tel El Amarna letters. And what they are is letters from these little princes and little kinglets that were in Canaan, writing back to the Pharaoh, explaining the situation, things like, you know, this is how many taxes we got this year from these people, and, you know, these things happen. But one of them is kind of interesting. It says this, the Habiru, the Habiru, who do you think that might possibly be? The Habiru plunder all the lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of the king, my Lord, are lost. So, remained or lost? Which was it, if you read the biblical record? Lost, but not all of them. Actually, if we read the biblical record, they did not take all the cities. All right? A number of the cities were left unconquered, as the Bible says. Again, proof that the Hebrews didn't, in fact... By the way, this comes from the 15th century, the 1400s BC, just so you know. All right, so there you go. So we have these people called the Habiru. They're indeed conquering areas of Canaan in roughly 1400 and something BC. So again, proof, I wouldn't go that far. Interesting evidence, I would say so. It's what happened to this thing? It's so different from the one that I have. I have no idea how it got changed because I... You know what, I think it may be that you have a different one than the one I have. That's all right. I can deal with that. All right, so let me talk about the Hittites. So you have to pretend there's a nice picture here. It used to be back in the 1800s, the skeptics would say there was no such place as Nineveh. That's old news. Nineveh, the whole idea of Jonah going to Nineveh and Nineveh attacking Israel. And then, of course, they discovered Nineveh, which is a massive city. That's old news. And then they said the Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, Perizzites, Canaanites, all these otherites, just stories. And the Hittites are mentioned 47 times in the Old Testament. And there's no such thing as a Hittite. That's just a story somebody made. All right? And then they discover the city of Hattusha, which there should be a picture up there. For some reason, it's not in the version that we're looking at right now. It's a large city. In fact, it was the capital of a large empire. And we now know that the three rival powers were Assyria, Egypt, and the Hittites. In fact, you can now, there's a couple of universities, such as Cambridge, where you can major in Hittite studies. So, you know what? I'm beginning to think maybe the Hittites and Hivites and Jebusites and the Perizzites and the Amorites, they're actual real people.
Yeah.
And, you know, slowly but surely, gradually, this knowledge keeps coming. Now, here's what the skeptics do. The skeptics say, none of this really happened. And they say, well, you've proved they're Hittites. They say, well, none of it happened except the Hittites. Then you show that David was a real person. Well, none of this happened, well, except maybe David was a real person. You see, this is the game they're playing. And what they don't accept, which is the obvious truth, which is that the Old Testament is the most accurate, most reliable, most complete history we have of the ancient world from any source whatsoever. You'd think they would acknowledge that. Then they'd have another great source of history rather than pretending it's made up stuff. All right, the next slide, if it was there, but it's not, is the gate to the city of Hattusha, the city that apparently wasn't supposed to even exist. It's the Lion Gate. It's a really, really awesome picture. I'm really sorry that it's not up there. I don't know how it got out of that. I got out of there. Surely it's there. I mean, come on. Well, it's not, though, apparently. All right, that's fine. We'll do without it. All right. What about Jericho? Now, Jericho has been excavated. And here are a few things they've discovered about Jericho. First of all, it was strongly fortified in the late Bronze Era at the time of the conquest. The city was massively destroyed by fire in roughly the mid-15th century B.C. Actually, the late 15th century B.C., around 1410, 1420 B.C. The walls collapsed at the time the city was conquered. All right. It could be by an earthquake or it could be because God just, I don't know, whatever. The destruction occurred at harvest time when the Jordan River would have been fairly high. They can tell that because they found large stores of grain in the granaries. The siege was fairly short because again, there was large stores of grain in the granaries. And contrary to what was customary, apparently when the city was plundered, they didn't take the grain and the food. They left it behind. Now those are the bare facts. They just happen to be consistent with what we know. Everything we know. All right? From the time. Man, the Tel Dan inscription is not even there? Which version did you put up there? It's my fault, I'm sure, but... I know. It's my fault. I know. My fault. All right. Anyway, you know, the Tel Dan inscription, that's such a cool one. The Tel Dan inscription. 820 B.C. Now, I happen to be friends with John Wilson. He's an archaeologist at Pepperdine University. He was in the city of Dan. Oh, keep pointing up there. He was in the city of Dan when the Tel Dan inscription was found on that day. He walked by the same exact spot where it was found, but it was in the morning and the sun wasn't right. And this rock was... what they would do back in ancient times is cities would get destroyed and rebuilt, and would just take the rocks and the old thing and just sort of use them to make the walls. And, of course, you have to understand that the skeptics said, David, who's David? Solomon, there was no Solomon, and Rehoboam, and this whole thing about Rehoboam and Jeroboam and the two separate houses, the northern and southern kingdom, whatever. You know, that's just stories. You know, the Jewish rabbis made that up in order to, you know, to make the kids obey their parents or whatever. Something like that. Okay, but it just so happens that's, well, they discovered the Tel Dan, what's known as the Tel Dan inscription, there in the city of Dan. By the way, the city of Dan is north. It's not. They're not. It's not going to stay. It's not going to stay. It's breaking. It's kind of like the city of Dan. It's all broken down and stuff. So anyway, Dan is north of the Sea of Galilee. It was in the farthest north period, a part of Israel, close to Assyria, what they called Aram back there. Anyway, in the Tel Dan inscription, it says this. This is the king, the king of Aram, bragging about what he'd done. And what he says is this. I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. So now we know, first of all, there were two separate dynasties, that of Ahab and that of David. And clearly David had a number of descendants, because this is roughly 820 B.C., which is about 220 years after David died. We know that. All right, we know that David had a very long-lasting dynasty. Now it says, I killed Ahab, and I also killed Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram. Now if you read 2 Kings 8, 28 through 29, it says that's not true. Actually, in that battle, he killed Jehoram, but Ahaziah was wounded. And later on, Jehu killed him. That's what it says. So the details agree, but there's one little discrepancy. Now let me ask just sort of a common sense question. Pretend you didn't understand the Bible is inspired by God. We have two different accounts. One said he killed them both. The other one said he killed one. He injured the other one. The other one later was killed by this guy Jehu. Now my question is, which is the more reliable account? To me, it's obvious, because the one has details that agree with the other one, except it says that one thing that's not true. In fact, this is what happened. So I would say in every single case, if we have alternate accounts of what happened, the Bible comes out at least as reliable, but almost certainly more reliable. If you read the histories of the Babylonians and the Assyrians, these guys never lost a battle. Not one. And you read the Old Testament, did the Jews ever win lose a couple of battles? I mean, all the time. The history of the Jews is just, on the face of it, far more believable. Okay, let's see if we have the next one. Let's see if I get lucky. All right, there you go. The Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser. One thing to note is, you know, if you're looking for carvings and statues of the Jewish kings, there are none. None. Which means those kings never really lived, right? Why are there no carvings and statues of the Jewish kings in Israel? Because God told them not to do that. They weren't faithful to a lot of things, but amazingly, they were faithful to that. So you will not find any carvings or inscriptions with pictures. But it just so happens, this is the black obelisk of Shalmaneser found in Nineveh. And there you have the one in the upper left. That's King Jehu bowing down to the king, Shalmaneser. All right, so you know what? I'm thinking maybe Jehu really was an actual person. And if you read 2 Kings 17, what it says is he was conquered by Shalmaneser and he paid tribute. It doesn't mention that he went and actually, you know, bowed down before him, but looks to me like he probably did. You know what? I'm thinking King Jehu might actually be a real person. I'm just thinking that might actually be the case. Excuse me for my sarcasm. By the way, that's in the British Museum. For me, going to the British Museum is like a child in a candy shop. They got this obelisk and the Taylor Prism. They have the Rosetta Stone and all these things. I would say about a third of all the pictures I'm showing you today, these are things that are actually found in the British Museum. So if you get a chance, you might want to go to the British Museum. It's pretty cool. Now, this is the Sennacherib cylinder. All right, it looks like this huge thing, but it's actually about this big. It's really small. The letters are tiny. All right, and this was the history of Sennacherib's reign. And Sennacherib was the one who came against Jerusalem in 709 B.C. All right, and in this cylinder is recorded the story that's in Isaiah 36, 18 through 21, and also Isaiah 37, 16 through 20, and also 2 Kings 18, 1 through 1937. And here's what Sennacherib says about Hezekiah. He says, "As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity. I drove out of them 200,150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, blah, blah, blah. And as for Hezekiah himself, I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage." End of story. So that's interesting. What does he not say about Hezekiah? He doesn't mention conquering him. All right? And naturally, because this is history of somebody other than the Jews, they never actually mention their defeats or their, you know, failures. He doesn't mention, "Yeah, because I never actually got around to conquering him." And that's the end of the story. Now, why does the story end there? Well, we know why it ends there. Because this entire army of 180,000 soldiers was destroyed that night outside of Jerusalem. I believe that. And then basically Sennacherib's story just comes to an end right there. If you read the Bible, what happens was he went back to Nineveh, and he was killed just a few months after he got back. Again, both in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, and this case here, we have not direct proof that a miracle happened, but we have is remarkable agreement between an actual history recorded by somebody else and history in the Bible, which seems to suggest, it certainly is consistent with the miracle that's described in the Bible. All right, proof of a miracle, I wouldn't go that far, but suggestive of that, I would say, yeah, for sure. Here's the Siloam inscription. Okay, now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah, all his might, how he made a pool and a tunnel, brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Hezekiah raised them with his fathers. All right, so that's the version in 2 Kings 20. But, you know, probably there was no Hezekiah because it's just a bunch of stories somebody made up. It's not as if these things actually really happened. And then sure enough, they were excavating the actual tunnel built by Hezekiah. And it was something like 1,800 feet long through solid rock. They started at the pool and at Jerusalem, met in the middle, which is really amazing. But then this inscription describes how they did that. They would actually, you know, hit on the rock above and listen to it. And it's an inscription describing how they met up in the middle and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, it mentions Hezekiah and all that kind of stuff. It says, and this was the story of the boring through, while the workmen were hacking their way from opposite ends, and while there were still 3 cubits to be bored through, they heard voices calling from each side, for there was a crevice in... This is what's in the inscription, mentioning Hezekiah. I don't know, I'm thinking maybe Hezekiah was a real actual guy, and maybe there really was this actual battle with Sennacherib going against him. Maybe they really did build this tunnel to bring water into the city as a defense against that. I don't know. Maybe believing the Bible has accurate history doesn't mean you're an idiot or a fool and just, you know, whatever. You just better stop thinking when you walk into church or whatever. That's just not consistent. You have to understand, this is typical, though. This is the Lakish room in the British Museum. It is amazing. All right? And what you have here, this was found not in Nineveh, but in, I can't remember which city, somewhere in Assyria. What would have been Assyria? All right? And basically, it's a detailed record of the destruction of Lachish, which is a city just outside Jerusalem. You can read Jeremiah. In fact, let's read Jeremiah 34, verses 6 and 7. This is really poignant. Jeremiah 34, verses 6 and 7. The Lachish room. Then Jeremiah the prophet told all this to Zedekiah. Jeremiah 34, 6 and 7. While the army of the king of Babylon was fighting against Jerusalem and the other cities of Judah, there were still holding out Lachish and Azekah. They were the only fortified cities left in Judah. All right, and we can see some of the events that went on in this war. These are Jewish slaves being taken away from Lachish, after the city was destroyed. All right, these are other pictures of the captives being taken back. These are pictures of Jews being flayed alive outside the city. What they would do is they would take the captives and put them up on poles in front of the city and just tear their skin off piece by piece. This is a picture of that actually happening. The Bible describes the Assyrians as being very cruel in the kind of things they did. And I think that this seems to confirm that picture there. These are more scenes of the captives being taken. These are all taken from the Lachish room. All right. Now, this is one of the Lachish letters. And if you go to the British Museum, they're there. And what they found is right beneath the wall of the city, they found a bunch of these letters written on ostraca, which is basically pieces of pottery in charcoal. All right. And these were left there when the city was destroyed and rubble fell on top of them. Okay, one of them, this one here, is written by somebody in the city. And what he says is that Azekah, the light in Azekah has just gone out. He's sending to Jerusalem asking for aid. And he says, if soldiers aren't here to protect us from the Assyrians, we're going to be destroyed very, very soon. Probably within a day or two of when this was written, the man who wrote it was killed in the destruction of Lachish, as is described in the book of Jeremiah. So you know what? I'm thinking probably this did actually happen. Probably the king did take Azekah first, and then Lachish. But not Jerusalem, just as described in the situation. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. It's sort of a sad story, I guess, but that's what happened. Okay, next is the Babylonian Chronicles. Okay, now this is found in Babylon, obviously, and it's describing in quite a bit of detail the events in 2 Kings 24, 10 through 17. It says, in the 7th year, in the month of Kislev, the king of Babylonia mustered his forces, marched to Syria. He camped against the city of Judah, that would be Jerusalem. And in the 2nd day of the month of Adar, he took the city, captured the king. He appointed a king and of his own choice, By the way, we know the name of that king. It's Zedekiah. The king he captured was Jehoiachin. All right, and he took Jehoiachin, according to the Bible, to Babylon. It's not mentioned there, but then again, what we can do is we can look. We can go to Babylon. This is an amazing discovery. It's found in the ruins. It was a ration list of people that the king was providing food for, and Jehoiachin is on the list. His actual name is on that list. And it's interesting, if you read in 2 Kings, and if you read in Jeremiah, it said that the king took special care of Jehoiachin and kind of lifted him up and treated him like a king. If you look at the list, Jehoiachin was given 20 times more food than all the other people in the list. I don't know. I'm thinking that maybe the description in the Old Testament of what happened with Jehoiachin, which is that he was taken to Babylon and treated like a king. In fact, it's interesting, if you read in Ezekiel, they act as if Jehoiachin's still the king, even though Zedekiah is the king that Nebuchadnezzar set up. So these are fun little facts and information that, again, I like I said, you cannot prove that David killed Goliath by archaeology. You never will be able to prove it, because if you found the body of Goliath, you wouldn't know it. And if you found, and by the way, in the city where this happened, they did excavate and they found hundreds of these little spears that were used for slings. Having slings as part of your army was standard back then in Israel. We know that. All right, now this is going to be the last one I'm going to do. There's more in my PowerPoint. I'm going to go on to the next topic here, but we're back at the ziggurat in Ur. The reason we are is because of Daniel chapter 5. Let's go to Daniel 5. Now, of all the Old Testament books, the ones that the skeptics and cynics and those who don't believe in the Bible and really wish nobody else did, the Old Testament book they're most interested in destroying credibility on is going to be the book of Daniel. And I wish we had time to do the book of Daniel. There's copies back there. By the way, you know, I don't want to take all those books back to San Diego, so please, please buy some. I don't know, maybe you top me down a dollar or two, because I don't want to carry them back with me to San Diego, okay? Anyway, the book on Daniel. And I explained there in some detail, but the fact is, the prophecies in Daniel are so ridiculously, insanely specific that a skeptic has to assume, not prove, but assume, that it was written after the events. And most of the events being described there happen in 167 and 164 B.C. in insane detail. I mean, and all the time even leading up to that. So they say Daniel was written around 150 B.C. roughly. Never mind the fact that we have Dead Sea Scrolls of Daniel from about that time, which means it was already canonized in the Hebrew scripture at that time. It was also translated into the Greek from Hebrew as part of the Septuagint by 200 B.C. Never mind all those facts. They say obviously it was written around 150 B.C. Why obviously? Because the Bible can't be inspired by God. Remember we talked about circular reasoning yesterday? But anyway, one of their proofs, obviously, that Daniel can't be inspired is because Daniel chapter 3 describes this king Belshazzar. Daniel 5. What's wrong with that? Because Herodotus mentions all the kings of Babylon and does not mention Belshazzar. All right, there were a number of historians, mainly Greek, but also Egyptian, who listed the kings of Babylon, and none of them mentioned Belshazzar. The only ancient document that mentioned Belshazzar is the one that's obviously, just a made-up story, the book of Daniel. All right, the last king, everybody said, was this guy Nabonidus. Well, then there was an inscription found in Ur, which was part of Babylon. It wasn't a major city of Babylon. It was mainly a ruin, but there was an inscription there. And it explained what happened. What happened was Nabonidus had a coup. And so he was not the legitimate king. But what he did was he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And by the way, that daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, she's a character in Daniel 5. She's that woman that you can see there. Anyway, so he had a child, and that child was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, therefore a legitimate heir and could be a king. So what Nabonidus did was he made him regent. And his name, according to the scripture, of course, is Belshazzar, naturally. All right? And in fact, Nabonidus basically didn't rule at all. He went off into sin. That's a little joke because the name of the city was Sin, a city in Arabia. That's an archaeology joke. He went into sin. You got it now? All right. All right. Anyway, so basically, Belshazzar ruled Babylon. Now, here's the funny thing. If you read the book of Daniel, remember he read the writing on the wall? And, you know, Belshazzar peed his pants there. It's kind of, you know, kind of a tense situation. And he says to Daniel, you know what? If you can read the writing on the wall, I'm going to give you the third highest place in the kingdom. The third highest place? Why the third highest place? Because Belshazzar occupied the second highest place. Now, if somebody had been writing 150 B.C., making up a story, then how would they have known that first of all, that Belshazzar even existed? Because all the historians who had written before then, there is no Belshazzar. How would they even know about him, never mind knowing that he could only give the third place in the kingdom? So you know what I'm thinking? I think a better conclusion is that Daniel was written by somebody who lived during the time of Belshazzar and Nabonidus and all that kind of stuff. All right? Anyway, I've got other archaeological stuff here. I'm going to skip all that. There's a bunch of other things in this PowerPoint that's not in that one, but I guess it doesn't matter. Great. Now, I'm going to take some questions. We're not done with this session, but I'm going to go on to the next thing about science and the Bible. So I'm going to take some questions and answers now before I start that section. Yes?
Is there any archaeological evidence for Noah's Ark?
No, and neither would there ever be. I mean, all right, we got this boat made out of what?
Wood.
All right, gopher wood or whatever wood is made out of. All right, I don't know. What do you think after they got out of the ark, what do you think they did with the wood?
Burned.
Probably burned it. I mean, it's not as if they're going to take the boat anywhere, you know. They might have built houses out of it. And so if you were to discover the actual wood, which is almost certainly not going to happen, I'd say 99.999% would never, ever happen. And how would you know it was the wood from the ark? And by the way, the Bible doesn't say it ended up on top of the mountain because it says the water subsided for quite a while, for months before they got out of the ark. So looking on top of a mountain, that's kind of a waste anyway. So this whole search for Noah's ark, that's just a complete waste of time. All right, so not only have they not, but plenty of people have said they found it. Don't believe it. Do not believe it. All right. Okay. Other questions, please. Yes.
Yeah. Good question.
All right.
What about like evidence for the flood and like along with that other civilizations having like the Epic of Gilgamesh having a flood account and, like other
yeah okay. Now, I'm going to tell you this. I believe the flood happened. The principal reason I believe the flood happened is because the Bible says so. I'm going to just put that right out there. All right. The Bible says that Abraham, lived in, you know, the thing we said with Laban and Jacob and, you know, the Nahor and Serug and these guys. So I believe the story about the flood. And I'm going to tell you right now, the principal reason I believe it is because God is powerful enough to do that. I know that. And because the Bible says so. Now, it just so happens that virtually every ancient culture, and what I mean by that is virtually every culture we know goes back to, you know, B.C., has a record of a worldwide flood. All right? And so, to me, that says probably there was a worldwide flood. All right? I'm not a supporter of the local flood theory. I'm not going to call somebody not a Christian because they go for the local flood theory. But to me, that doesn't really make much sense. I mean, if you read the account in Genesis 7, the number of the times the word all is in there is, I've actually counted it, all and every. So I believe there was a massive flood which affected the whole world, whether it covered Mount Everest. I don't think it covered Mount Everest. You know, I wouldn't take it that far, but I think there was a massive flood. I believe it was a miracle. So if you're trying to look for a natural explanation of a miracle, that's kind of a waste of time. But the evidence for that is, it's interesting. The best I would say is, the evidence that this worldwide massive flood happened is interesting, but certainly not conclusive. And I already said, the first thing I said is, I believe this happened just like you believe in Adam and Eve and Methuselah and these other people, by faith, Enoch. Okay? So I don't have a lot of evidence. My main evidence is it's recorded in the Bible. But the fact that in every continent, the Iroquois, the Assyrians, there is the Gilgamesh epic, etc. In China, Africa, every continent, there's stories of this great flood. There are three myths that are found worldwide. Those are creation myths, flood myths, and God-man myths. All right? And by the way, the Bible has those myths as well. It's got a creation myth. It happens to be a true myth. What do you mean a true myth? Well, what's a myth anyway? A myth is a simplified story given to explain a supernatural thing. And by definition, I guess the Genesis story is a myth. It just happens to be true. And the Bible has a true flood myth and a true God-man myth as well, by the way. It's Jesus. All right, another question. Yeah.
My question was about actually the book and the history.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that when I was reading through about the kings, it says, but you can find more about this king and this record. Do we have those records?
Nope, we don't. We have almost no books from the ancient world, virtually none, certainly none from back then. We don't have any books from that time. We know there were books. We have a lot of inscriptions on walls, but books didn't make it. But apparently they were annals of the kings of Judah, and there was this Jagar one. So there were a number of sources. So the writers of 1st and 2nd Kings, the writers of 1st and 2nd Chronicles were using written records to produce their accounts. Those other accounts, I'm guessing, probably weren't inspired. All right, but being careful historians, just like Luke, they use reliable sources rather than just sort of, you know, doing the best they could. Yeah.
This might be a silly question, but a while ago, in like one of the first Crusades, the Catholic Church or the whatever church was established attacked the Muslims, and they claimed to have the true cross with them, and then afterwards they got routed. And then the true cross that they thought actually was Jesus' cross was taken by these Muslim conquerors at the time.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that that might have actually been what it
was? Well, I've heard it said that if you took all the fragments of the true cross, you could build a massive mansion out of it. And during the late Middle Ages, there was an industry, a huge industry producing these relics. You know, my sister is a Orthodox nun, and I visited her. She's in Kansas City. I visited her just a couple days ago there in her little monastery thing. And one thing she said is, you can't worship, you can't do the Lord's Supper unless you had a relic. That was interesting. A relic is like an actual physical object, supposedly, you know, of some saint from your... you know, come on now. Did any of these tens of thousands of relics, were they actual bones of actual people, actual lived? Probably. I believe it's very likely, certainly more than 50%, but maybe more than 90%, that Peter is actually buried in St. Peter's. But obviously, virtually all these relics were just, you know, made up. And the Shroud of Turin is very interesting. It's very, very interesting. But it's not the burial shroud of Jesus. Come on. Did somebody take the actual crossbeam that was used to kill Jesus and pull it down? That doesn't sound like something the apostles would have done. It just doesn't sound that way. But anyway, the bottom line is we would never know. Let's stop. Thank you for asking your awesome, amazing question. But let's stop even thinking about this. Would it matter? I mean, first of all, we could never, ever know. You could literally never, ever know if it was. And even if it was, so what? You know, it's just a piece of wood. So that's a fun question. And I'm gonna say, let's say 99% of the relics that are buried in these churches, just, you know, whatever, somebody just found something and said it was, and they had this vision. Who knows? Maybe they ate some bread with some funny mold on it or whatever. I don't know. All right. But there was a cottage industry of large proportions to produce these relics. Okay. Yes, there, and then back over here.
Do you know, like, why or how or who, like, just, like, decided to date, like,
our years around Jesus? Like,
yeah, that was in, I believe it was the 500s. It was a Latin scholar. I can't, you know, if you read my second volume of church history, which hasn't been published yet, I can't remember the guy's name, but I mentioned there who it was and where he lived. And so that was in the, I believe it's the 6th century AD. It was a monk. I believe it was a Catholic as opposed to an Eastern monk. Pretty sure. I wouldn't guarantee that. And the problem is he missed by about 6 years. Because Jesus was born in 6 B.C., possibly 5 B.C., but more likely 6 B.C. Herod died in 4 B.C. Herod, the one who persecuted and killed the babies, and that was a few months later. So Jesus was either born in 5 B.C. or, in my opinion, more likely 6 B.C., which is kind of funny. So anyway, I appreciate the person. Basically, this was the period of Christendom. So to them, it seemed obvious to date, because every culture had a zero, and they based it on some important period, and there's the Mayans, and obviously, you know, the 2012, the world was going to end with rats, you know. So, that's the story there. Yes?
With the access of the internet, we get bombarded with all these new discoveries
mm-hmm.
in archaeology.
Yeah.
What are, like, your top, I guess, 3 journals that you feel are reliable?
The Biblical Archaeology Review is the best one. Now, see, I've been kind of giving archaeologists a bit of a hard time here. I'm being a little bit more harsh than probably I should be, to be honest with you. Because the bottom line is, it's archaeologists' job to let the discovery say no more than it certainly says. That's their job. Okay, to me, Biblical Archaeology Review gives the most balanced picture of these things. The authors clearly believe that there is a God and the Bible is inspired by God, but they're extremely cautious, more cautious than I am, to be honest with you. They're extremely cautious in saying this thing implies that. And I've tried to be fairly careful. I've tried to set a reasonably good example of saying, let's not have this prove more than it actually proves. But, you know, I might go a little bit farther maybe than the Biblical Archaeology Review. But I think you're better off reading a conservative thing. The best source is conservative and yet open to a biblical worldview. And so I would suggest the Biblical Archaeology Review. I used to subscribe to it, but I wasn't reading all the articles, so I stopped subscribing. But it's pretty good.
Is there a website?
Well, I don't know. You can look that up. It's not expensive. But I don't know. If you're a student, you probably think it's expensive. Yes?
How do you account for the differences in between Joshua and Judges as far as the entrance into the Promised Land?
Which difference is that?
Well, Joshua kind of, unless I'm mistaken, Joshua kind of gives a more go in and burn and destroy and kill everything kind of thing. And Judges describes more of a tactical approach.
To be honest with you, I don't understand what you're talking about. I've read those accounts pretty carefully. Judges begins long after the conquest, like 40 years after the conquest. So to be honest with you, I don't know what you're talking about. Can you give me a specific example of a specific thing in a specific chapter?
I think I should study more.
All right. Judges begins with a generation grew up that had not known these things. Judges begins roughly 40 years after the conquest. Now, if you read in Joshua, it describes 3 cities that were taken by fire. And that was Ai, Jericho, and the other one. Oh. It was in my brain a minute ago. It happens when you get to be old like me. And it's interesting. One of the things that archaeologists noticed is that there was relatively little destruction. If you look in Canaan in around 1400, 1390, 1410 BC, you find relatively little destruction. In fact, the only two massively destroyed cities were Jericho, the one whose name I forgot, which is even a larger city, and it's embarrassing that I'm forgetting right now, and then Ai. Ai has not been found yet. There's been some proposals. Bethel may actually be Ai, but the bottom line is Ai has not been definitively discovered. So it just so happens, the information is, of all these cities, very few were destroyed by fire. Jericho was, and the one whose name I'm forgetting right now, sorry about that, it's kind of embarrassing. And then none of those have been found to have been burned at that time. So that's consistent with the description in Joshua. Now, what you're seeing in Judges that's not consistent, oops, what you're seeing in Judges is not consistent, I it's hard to respond to that. You'd have to give me a specific thing. All right? Good. Well, let's go on to the next presentation then. Are we ready to do the one about? All right, great. Let's do it. I'm going to get mine going. All right, science and Christian apologetics here. Okay, great. This would be another course I'm teaching. There's way too much stuff on this presentation. I probably should use one that has less stuff, but that's what I'm going to do. So there we go. Okay, so we're going to talk about science. I'm not going to finish this presentation. I'm going to go maybe another, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes, and then we'll take a break. So I'm not even going to come close to finishing this presentation. Okay, great. Same one. These are going to be exactly the same this time. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about science and religion. I'm going to skip through this really, really fast because this is these are notes from a 10-hour course that I have to shorten to an hour or so. History of science and Christianity, the Christian response to this, age of the universe, age of the earth, Genesis 1 and creation, the flood, evolution, the anthropic principle. I want to spend more time on the anthropic principle and science of the Bible, which are kind of near the end of this presentation. So I'm going to do a lot of skipping here, so bear with me. All right, these are some sources. That's nice. Blah, blah, blah. What is it? All right, we have to think about what science is good at. Science is good at measuring things like length of time, size, mass, distance, speed, things like that. And science is not very good at measuring things like we talked about earlier, like value and things like that. Some of what I'm covering here is going to overlap what I talked about in the first part when we talk about atheism. Let me see. Scientific knowledge. Like I said, these are questions that science is pretty good at answering. When, what, where, how many? These questions it's not very good at answering. We should probably, just as a general approach, we should let science get the first stab at questions like, how long ago did that happen? All right, where did that happen? How did that happen? Probably we should let science take the first stab at that, and then later on come back in and ask, does that fit with the biblical description? On the other hand, things like what's the purpose of life? What's the, what is a person? What is a human being? What's right? What's wrong? Things like that. Probably we should let religious approaches get the first stab at it, and scientists should probably just shut their mouths and be quiet about it, unless they're talking from a biblical or a religious perspective. Okay. this is interesting. These are the basic assumptions of science. I teach a philosophy of science class. The assumption is that there exists a single unchanging set of laws which governs all events in the physical universe. Guess where that assumption came from? All right, go ahead. From the Bible. The first philosopher, if it were not for Christianity, science would not have been created. That's a historical fact. It's worth noting. Basically, there are a number of people, but Roger Bacon is most notable. He concluded as a theologian, because there is one unchanging God of the whole universe, that if you study the natural world, there should be one unchanging set of laws for the whole universe. And that is what I say to my science philosophy students. That is the fundamental presupposition of science. Other important assumptions of science are that human beings are able to understand the workings of the universe. And Roger Bacon concluded, because God wanted us to know him, that nature would have to be understandable by human reason. And it turns out it is, and that's one of the assumptions of science. Another thing he said, it is so amazing, Roger Bacon said that nature has to be describable by mathematics. Why? Because God is a God of order and beauty and these kinds of things. These are the fundamental presuppositions of science. I'm not teaching science or religion, I'm just teaching the history and philosophy of science. And it just so happens, all three of these conclusions were taken directly from the Bible by theologians. So, I don't know, that's worth noting when people say, how can any, religious person ever, be a scientist? And all the early scientists were not only religious, and Roger Bacon, Copernicus, all these people studied science as a branch of theology. All right? They called it natural philosophy. So this is worth noting, okay? Like I said, Christian theology predicts all these things. All right, I'm going to do a lot of skipping here. Galileo. Galileo's a pretty smart guy. He said, the Bible's written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Got that? That's kind of a smart saying. The Bible's written to show us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So if you want to know how the heavens go, according to Galileo, you should use a telescope. He didn't invent the telescope, but it was invented a year before he built his first, and he was the first one really to turn a telescope at the skies. It seems like wise advice. So the Bible is not written to tell us how old the earth is or how long man has been around. All right? And now, if it gives us information relevant to that, that's fine, but that would be by accident more than anything else because that was not the intention. Now, of course, this is just Galileo talking. This is not inspired. And he said, in discussions of physical problems, we ought to begin not from the authority of scripture passages, but from sense experiences and necessary demonstrations. He's saying what I said a few minutes ago, which is, if we're discussing those questions which science is good at answering, such as, how did this happen? How does this work? How many? How long? How big? And things like that. Probably we should let science get the first stab at it. And then we should not answer the question using the Bible. Probably we should ask is, does the Bible agree with this? If it doesn't, that means probably the Bible's wrong. Not science is wrong. Now that's an interesting way to think about it. You might have heard of this guy, Augustine. The greatest theologian in history, after Jesus and Paul. And Augustine, he did not start out as a Christian. All right, he was a part of a dualistic religion, and he was devoted to that. And the leader of that religion came to town, and he started asking them questions about the heavens and the stars, because they thought there's people on the moon, and that the earth eats part of the moon, and God, and all this crazy, weird cosmology stuff that all other religions but Christianity has. And he asked them, how do you explain that? Because he's smart. He's just one of these annoying, smart people. You know what I'm saying? And the guys just said, basically, you need to have faith. And so Augustine, in his book, Confessions, if you read Confessions of Augustine, that's an interesting read. It's a brilliant book. Anyway, he said, if a religion makes predictions about the natural world that are not true, then we should not accept that religion. And that's why he became a Christian. Okay, because the Bible does not contradict anything that he knew about nature. Not that he knew a whole lot about nature, but nevertheless. All right, this is good stuff. Newton, I'm going to skip all this. Laplace, and creationism, intelligent design. I talked about intelligent design a bit already, did I not?
Yeah.
I am going to talk about the anthropic principle. That'll be a little ways. This is good stuff. Francis Collins, he's a great guy. Yeah. All right, let's talk about the age of the universe. All right, we're going to be on the age of the universe. Okay. Now, again, Oh, okay, but yeah, that's Bishop Usher. Yeah. Now, again, Bishop Usher made what I believe is a tactical error. In my opinion, he made a tactical error. He assumed that the Bible is a science book, and therefore you could use it to determine the age of the earth and the universe, and you picked October 23rd, 4004 BC. Again, I believe that was a mistake. All right. By the way, Galileo lived to about 1642, so these guys are contemporaries. If Usher had asked Galileo's opinion, Galileo would have said, shh, don't even say that. It's, you know. All right, so how old is the Earth? Like I say in my science classes, I say, I don't know how old the Earth is. I don't know how old the universe is either. I just don't know that. And not only do I not know that, I can't know that. But what we can do is we can use science to, you know, attempt to come up with an answer to that question. Whether it'll be the answer in the end, we have to admit. So there's this thing called, you know, you know about the redshift and all that kind of stuff. You know, the car comes like, and when it's coming at you, it's higher frequency. When it's going away from you, it's lower frequency. You're aware of that. Okay, yes? All right, and so is blue shift, is red shift, because blue is higher frequency and red is lower frequency. And it just so happens when we look at light coming from distant objects, okay, when we look at light coming from distant objects, the light is shifted to the red. So you see the spectra, you can't really read it from there. You see the spectra, the top one is light coming from the sun. The second one is light coming from a galaxy maybe a few million light years away. And you can see all those lines are slightly to the right. You see that? Mm-hmm. And then you can see one from a distant galaxy, let's say a billion light years away. You can see they're even farther to the right. And then if you look at a quasar, which is something like 10 billion light years away, they're shifted even farther. What that means is the farther something is away from the Earth, the faster it's moving away from the Earth, which is clear proof that the universe is expanding. All right? And the people who originally discovered this is back in the 1920s and 30s. Hubble concluded, therefore, that the universe is getting larger, therefore it used to be much, much smaller. And they came out with this crazy idea that it might have been infinitely small at one point, that it started from essentially nothing, and thus came the Big Bang Theory. All right? So there you go. Galaxies, and there's some pretty cool things here. There's Hubble's law. Basically, this graph, and look at the graph. The graph says the farther away, the faster it's moving away. Okay, it's pretty clear. So we have the universe expanding. I have to do tons of... There's lots of proof of the Big Bang Theory, the microwave background radiation. I don't have time for all this sort of stuff. The bottom line is, the clear conclusion from the information is that the universe began. It has not always existed. Which, of course, is what the Bible said all along, in the beginning, all right, which means there was a beginning. In the beginning, God, which means God preexisted the universe. In the beginning, God created, which means the entire universe was created, not out of, he didn't reform it out of other matter like Hindus say and like Buddhists say. No, it's actually formed it out of nothing. That's what the Bible says. That's what science says. Okay, that's kind of cool. All right, how about the age of the universe? It turns out there's two ways to measure the age of the universe. These are scientific details you may not really need to know. One is by measuring the age of the oldest object, which is a certain kinds of galaxies. These are elliptical, not spiral galaxies. These tend to be older, and they tend to evolve much, much, much more slowly. There's certain kinds that are very old. And just like you could guess the age of a person by looking at them, you can guess the age of a star by looking at that. And the estimates are the oldest stars are roughly 13.3 billion years old. And none are seen to be older than that. So therefore, the universe is, you know, a little bit older than that, maybe 13.5 billion years old. Okay? Got it? Now, and then the other means to measure it is from the distance to the largest object. So if you imagine from the farthest object is moving away from us at the speed of light, and they're 13.5 billion years away, light years away, 13.5 billion years, okay? The bottom line is there are two methods to measure the age of the universe. Both agree to within about less than 5%, okay? So therefore, the scientific answer to the age of the universe is 13.5 billion years. Therefore, the universe is 13.5 billion years old. We don't know. I have no idea. I already told you yesterday, I believe God could have gone wappo blammo, there's the universe, galaxies already created. All of us believe God could do that. Every single one here believes that. Maybe that's what God did. If so, for some reason, which is hard for me to explain, he made it appear to be 13.5 billion years old from two possible ways you could measure it. Maybe what he's doing is leaving room for people to not believe. All right, fine. All right, but I'm just telling you, this is the scientific fact. Okay, now we could talk about the age of the Earth. We can talk about James Hutton and the geology. All I know is the Earth is old. If you think the Earth is like a few thousand years old, if you look at that picture and you can with a straight face say to me, the Earth is only a few thousand years old, your powers of observation, I don't know. I don't know how to respond to that. Yeah. All right? I hiked to the bottom and back just last April in one day. Take you guys down there, see if you can do it. All right, that's quite a hike. I took that picture. All right. William Smith was the first one to start finding index fossils. What he noticed is the order of the fossils is conserved. So certain things are always lower, other things are always higher. All right, and there's a clear progression. The farther down layers are older. He didn't know the ages. What he knew is clearly the Earth is quite old, obviously. He had no idea how old, but you could say definitely you're not going to find trilobites and dinosaurs in the same rock. That would never happen. It never does. And I assume it never will. If it did, maybe stuff got jumbled up or whatever. All right, and I'm not going to go into all this sort of stuff, but you have uranium dating and you have a potassium-argon dating and thorium-lead dating and all these things. By the way, if people say, we know from carbon dating the Earth is only a few thousand years old, that person clearly knows not what they're talking about. Just, okay, thank you so much. Because carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,700 years. Got it? So the oldest thing you could even begin to date using carbon is maybe 30,000 years, and that's really at the outside. So here's how it works. Archaeology, carbon-14. Geology, paleontology, uranium-lead. Okay? Anyway, geologists estimate the age of the Earth to be 4.5 billion years. They've not found a single rock that old in the Earth. The oldest rock found on the Earth is around 4.3 billion years because there's been a lot of turnover. So where do they find 4.5 billion year old rocks? On the moon. Why? Because there's no geology happening on the moon. On Mars. Interestingly, from Mars, some of the rocks are close to that age, but others are younger. Why? Because Mars has had much, much, much less geologic change, but it's had some. And yes, we have found Martian rocks. They're found in Antarctica. I'm not kidding. And they know that because there's a certain fingerprints for the distribution of certain elements. So Martian rocks have been found. And there's a mixture. But virtually all meteorites, when you measure their age, turn out to be around 4.5 billion. So here you go. Universe, 13.5. Earth, 4.5 billion. All right, that's the scientific answer. In the case of the Earth, in the case of the universe, there's only two known means to measure it. They're consistent. In the case of the age of the Earth, there's something like 5, 6, 7 different approaches to approximating the age. Some say between 1 and 10 billion. You know, they're not very precise. They all sort of focus in on the same conclusion. So I'm going to say, I don't know, probably that's how old the Earth is. So what about Genesis then? What do we do with Genesis? All right, there's different theories. There's the young Earth theory. And I already said, you can go with the young Earth theory, but you just have to, please, if you're going to do that, I respect that. I'm not going to laugh at you. I promise. I respect that. I'm sincere about that. Unlike many people in my position who are Christians but scientists, they kind of, oh, whatever, you know. I'm absolutely serious about that. I believe God could have done that. I believe he might have done that. I don't know that he didn't do that. And I'm probably biased, so there you go. Okay, but please don't say that's a scientific idea. And please don't try to defend it from science. And those of your friends in your churches who do, you know, what can I say? Try to help them out. Okay? Anyway, there's the day-age theory, which says basically, let me get to the next slide so we can see how that's going to work. Okay, basically, here's my very, very, very brief analysis, our summary of Genesis 1. God created the universe, right? God created light, He created the earth, He created life, and then He created people. So where's the mistake there? I don't see a lot of mistakes in that. Then we could have the more kind of the more detailed version. I'm trying to get caught up in my PowerPoint here to what I'm doing. Okay, and then we could go for the more detailed description, which says, first the earth was created and it's spinning. That's why we have night and day. Then water covered the earth. And there was a very thick atmosphere. The reason I know that is there was night and day, but they couldn't see the sun and the moon and the stars. Right? Because the sun and moon and stars didn't even appear, at least visually, from the surface till the fourth day. Anyway, then as the earth cooled, land appeared up out of the water. Scientists also agree with that. It was covered with water, but later on land appeared out of the water. And then on day three, life appears in the water. Then on day four, because as the bacteria changed the atmosphere, scientists believe the early Earth's atmosphere was mainly methane and ammonia and sulfur dioxide and hydrogen sulfide, no nitrogen, no oxygen at all, or virtually none. Here's a good trick question. If you were on the surface of Venus, how often would you see the sun?
Never.
Never. Thank you. Never. Because the atmosphere is way too thick. All right, so on the fourth day, because of changes that we know, we have evidence for this. For example, in the early Earth, there was a lot of free iron, but somewhere around 2.5 billion, don't quote me on the exact number, roughly in there, iron started to become oxidized. We have all these red rocks. Go to Colorado, there's lots of them. It's because photosynthesis started to release oxygen to the atmosphere, but the level of oxygen in the atmosphere stayed very low because it was oxidizing the iron. And basically, after a billion years or so, don't quote me on the number, I'd have to look it up, but something like that, there was enough oxygen so that the amount of free iron started to go down, oxygen in the atmosphere started to go up, and finally, around 450-something million years ago, you started to have animals. All right, now, apparently this is the process God used to create a planet on which we could live. It seems that way. All right? And Genesis, basically it says God did this, then He did this, then He did this, then He did this, then He did that, then He did that, then He did that. It just so happens. It just so happens. As far as I know, in every detail that we have in Genesis, it's not in contradiction with anything we know. Okay, that's my perspective on this for what it's worth. So we go back to our theories. There's the day-age theory, which is I just described. There's the gap theory, which I don't subscribe to, which says, basically, in Genesis 1, it says God created the heavens and the earth, all right? And then there's this huge gap, and then the 6 days of creation happened about 6,000 years ago. And that was created to make Genesis be scientific. You know, but in my opinion, it doesn't solve any of the problems. And any answer created to answer a difficulty, that's not based on evidence, I find that to be kind of kludged up, and I don't agree with that. And of course, then there's the idea, that's just a myth, you know. The Genesis story is just a myth. I don't agree with that for a few reasons. One of the reasons I don't agree with that is the Bible's inspired by God, and it seems to all be inspired by God. The other reason I don't agree with that is it just so happens that the Genesis myth is a true myth. I mean, if it's a myth, wow, that's amazing. You know, because it just so happens, unlike all other creation myths, we're going to look at some of the creation myths. There's some kind of fun creation myths. Unlike all the other creation myths, the Genesis creation myth happens to agree in detail, even in the order of how it happened, including details that nobody in the ancient world seems like they could have known, with what we know from science. So I'm thinking, I don't know, it's because that's what actually happened. But you have to remember, no matter what, even if it turns out that Genesis 1 is consistent with scientific knowledge, I mean, that's not the point. The point of Genesis 1 is in the beginning, and in the beginning God, and in the beginning God created, and in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. You know, by the time you get to the end of Genesis 1, if Genesis 1:1 is true, then dualism is defeated, pantheism is defeated, atheism is defeated, polytheism, animism, dualism, postmodernism, every ism ever created by man is proved wrong if Genesis 1:1 is right. And it just happens that Genesis 1:1 agrees with what we know from science. I didn't include deism, by the way. Deism isn't disproved until Genesis chapter 2. All right? So there you go. So you have Christian theism and deism are the only possible views. That's assuming Genesis 1:1 is true. And it just happens, at least from a scientific perspective, it's consistent with what we know. So that's all. I'm going to go on to the next thing from there. And probably some questions are coming up. And feel free to ask those questions. So is it a myth? Yeah. It's a true myth. Okay? That's the way I would see it. A myth is a simplified story given to explain the gods or God or supernatural things to common people. That's exactly what Genesis is. Genesis 1. That's exactly what it is. It just so happens to be true. All right, so then we have the Babylonian creation myth. All right, which has this primeval swamp, and Marduk kills Tiamat, and then the blood joins with the mud, and the humans are formed, and with the Egyptian creation myth, with this primeval ocean, and this nun, which arrives from the primeval hill, which was somewhere in Egypt, and we have the Greek creation myth, Prometheus and Epimetheus, they're making these clay molds, and people come out of those, the Iroquois creation myth with Enigorio and Enigo Tageha, the good and evil brothers do battle and the islands are created. All these creation myths are like, okay, that's interesting. That's kind of neat, kind of cool story. But they all contain information to kind of go, well, you know, obviously. In fact, even the people who said the Iroquois myth, I think even they knew it was a myth. It was just a story. But the Genesis myth, in quotes, interesting to me, seems to agree. So here's Marduk killing Tiamat. There it is. Here's the Egyptian creation myth, which is kind of, I'm going to go to the next slide. I was kind of, here's Enigorio chasing Enigo Haka Tegea and battling the Rananawetowankas, stone giants. All right, again. Not to disrespect the Iroquois, right? Because it's a myth, and that's their story. And then you read the Genesis story; it doesn't have giants and, you know, clay molds and people holding up the earth. And all. It says first the universe, then the earth, light, darkness, water, land, life in the water, life on the land, and people. Okay. So, and then this is the defense of this. I don't want to go into, you know, I'm going to skip the flood. I mean, we can talk about the flood. You can ask questions about the flood. I've already fielded one or two questions about the flood. So I'm just going to skip the whole flood thing, the comment. All right, let's talk about evolution for a while, okay? Talk about evolution. Okay. Now, evolution, that kind of gets a little bit controversial, doesn't it? But you need to be prepared to talk about that, right? Now, let me give you the quick version. God invented evolution, so why not just give him credit for it? I mean, evolution, if evolution happened, it's because of an incredible, amazing design that allowed it to happen. And getting all defensive about evolution seems to be, that's a bad policy. So if God, now, my personal opinion is God did not sort of wind up the clock and let the machine run on its own. I believe God intervened. And in fact, I believe that the fossil evidence is more consistent with interventional than simply random. Not only do I believe that the fossil evidence is more consistent with interventional things than just a random process, I believe the actual DNA itself is more consistent with God intervening to cause what happened to happen rather than simply let it go by random. But let me tell you right now, what I just said is not a scientific belief. All right, it's a theological belief that's consistent with science, but it's not a scientific belief for this simple reason. I can't experiment. I can't do an experiment to test what I just said. I can't confirm it by experiment. I can't test it by experiment. Therefore, what I said is really not a strictly scientific conclusion. But I believe that conclusion is consistent with everything we know from the science. In fact, I believe if you look at it with an open mind, that it's more consistent with that whole totally random, you know, atheist idea. Now, some Christians who are scientists agree with that. We did a debate on evolution about 4 years ago. The title was Four Christian Views of Evolution. One of the four debaters took this full sort of deistic perspective, which he says, you know, God is so powerful, so amazing, so awesome, that when he wound up the machine and let it go, it just, humans came out of that. I don't agree with that. I don't think any set of random circumstances would have turned a bacteria into an elephant. All right, but he believes that, and I'll have to say that I can't disprove him from the science. I really can't. And that was a fun debate. And by the way, another person in the debate was John Clayton. I don't know if some of you know who John Clayton is. It was kind of interesting debating against John Clayton. He's a good friend of mine. And we actually both agree with each other. We kind of sort of did it just to frame the debate. He took the intelligent design perspective. I took the theistic evolution perspective. Then we had the young earth creationist guy. anyway. So, there's evidence. There's evidence for evolution. Now, it's possible to overstate that evidence, and atheists and many others do overstate that evidence. You know, I've heard stuff like evolution is a fact. That is nonsense. All right, evolution is a theory, like any other theory. All right, and so people who say that, they're just trying to manipulate you. Either that, or they just don't understand how scientists should say things. What they should say instead is something like this. The evolutionary theory is the most useful theory we have to explain all the evidence concerning fossils and DNA. I don't know of an alternative theory to explain it. If there were, probably we would have heard about it. All right? Now, does this theory prove there's no God? That's ridiculous. Does it prove that the Bible's not true? I don't agree. I don't think so. I mean, even if you're a young earther, a sort of a theological young earther, you say, you know, God created the universe to appear old. All right? Even if that's the case, the evidence for evolution doesn't, at least technically, disprove that possibility. So there's plenty of stuff in the horses and all that. But it's interesting because then there's the Cambrian explosion. And there's the punctuated equilibrium and all that sort of stuff. Because it turns out roughly 450 million years ago, before that, let me see if I have, what's the next slide? Do I have the picture? This is pretty good. So, basically, according to the evidence, unicellular life appeared around 3.5 billion years ago, give or take, you know, few hundred million years. And then we had very, very, very simple life forms with no body parts, no definable separate organs or anything. And then roughly 450 million years ago, suddenly, all five phyla appeared. Now, there are five phyla. We happen to be members of the chordata phyla, and then there's the one that insects have. And if you ask me too many questions, I'm not a biologist. What's the name for the insect phyla? I don't know. Help me out, somebody.
Arthropods.
All right, there's five of them. All five phyla appear in the fossil record essentially instantaneously. So before that Cambrian explosion, no animals at all. And in fact, no species with any significant structure. And then next layer down, there's hundreds of different species. All five phyla are there. I don't know, to me, that's just practically a smoking gun. All right? For creation. All right? I'm going to go back in my slide. Cool. There's this one called the hallucinogenia. I think there's a fossil. Maybe not. The hallucinogenia, that's the one in the lower right-hand corner. There's... Yep, that's the actual fossil, yeah. No, there's no hallucination. These are actual fossils, including trilobites, by the way. Trilobites are arthropods. And I think the one on the bottom is actually a chordate, chordata or whatever. Does this prove that God intervened and did these creations? I don't know. But I'll just leave it at that. Now, here's something. This might bother you just a little tiny bit. Okay, you can't read the slides. So let me tell you what's on the slide. All right. Okay. Now, look at the picture on the right. On the left is the human chromosome number 2. And on the right is the chimpanzee chromosome number 2P and 2Q. All right? It seems that... See on the left one, H, human, C, chimp, G, gorilla, O, orangutan. And it seems, at least from a chromosome point of view, it seems probably that there's a common ancestor. All right, it seems that way.
And we have 46 and they have 48.
Yeah. Correct. So it seems like there was an event. The event probably was not the splitting, it was not the joining of the two chromosomes, but the splitting. All right? And here's another interesting fact. All mammals produce vitamin C, except orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, humans, and guinea pigs. Now, we have the oncogene. The oncogene. In other words, we have the gene to create vitamin C, but it doesn't work. As do chimps, gorillas, and orangutans. And the same mutation that made it not work is in all four of those. A different mutation is what made guinea pigs not make vitamin C. Okay? Anyway, I could go on and on. I suggest you read Francis Collins' book. All right, The Language of God. You read Francis Collins' book. Bottom line is the evidence leans in the direction of common descent. Okay, that's where the evidence points. Now, I already told you I believe that Adam and Eve were created. I believe that. I believe God. Here you go. And Eve. Not Steve. Adam and Eve, or whatever I said yesterday. I can't remember. The other guy. Whatever I said. Don't quote me on that, please. Or if you can, you can make a joke at my expense. It's okay. It's fine. All right. This I'm just giving you the information as it is. The fossil evidence is not particularly conclusive towards common descent. It supports common descent, but it doesn't very strongly prove common descent. But the genetic evidence strongly supports common descent. Okay? What I mean by common descent, which is that there were not very many species and species evolved from them. I believe given the Cambrian explosion, we could argue for a certain number of original created species rather than one. But there you go. Okay, then there's the pseudogenes and the retroposons and the short interspersed elements. And you know, read Francis Collins' book, you don't care about viral insertions and all this stuff. Common descent is a slam dunk, more or less. Okay, more or less. And facts like this. The genetic information in chimpanzees and humans is almost rounds off to 100% similar. If you include the non-gene stuff, it's 98%. Dogs, the genetic composition is 99% similar, but other stuff, including those random things in between, is 52% similar to humans. Mice, 99% and 40%. Chickens, 75% and 4%. Fruit flies, 60% and practically none. All right, so yeah, it just seems to fit this general idea. All right, so nevertheless. I believe if you do some simple calculations, how many mutations are required? And how many generations are required? And how many actual of these animals existed to allow these mutations to create this much positive change over time? I believe random numbers don't even allow for that. I personally don't agree at all that, you know, God wound up the machine and it just went. Okay? But the bottom line is, there seems to be some evidence, anyway, that there were evolved primates living, you know, 3 million years ago. All right? With common descent. Right, and that humans at least have genetic evidence of that common descent. So here's some tentative conclusion. Number one, evolution has happened. Microevolution in the laboratory has been observed directly. Fossil evidence supports the idea of change over time, but it happens in surprisingly sudden ways, and there's Cambrian explosion. Genetic evidence gives rather strong support to common descent, like it or not, true of humans as well. Statistical and other arguments give support for evolution being theistic, in other words, God's finger, God causing these changes over time. And God invented evolution. Let's give him credit for this amazing idea. Okay? Good. Now, I think we should stop there because of time and take a break. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into evidence from science for God and evidence from science for the Bible. Should we take a couple of questions or should we have our break? A couple of questions, then the break. We'll finish about science and God this morning, and then we'll have our last section in the afternoon. Yes?
Would you take the evolution theory as an acceptable kind of defense for the what people often think of the contradiction in when Cain and Adam, or like when Cain broke off and he was afraid that other people were going to kill him?
So you're asking, who did Cain marry? All right, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to give you two possible answers. And I prefer one. I don't prefer the other, but I'm going to give you two possible answers. Okay, now, again, I believe the Bible is inspired by God. I'm just going to come right out there. I believe Adam lived for hundreds of years. I believe Eve lived for hundreds of years. So did Methuselah and Seth and all these people. And Cain, Abel didn't live hundreds of years. And All right. And I don't know. Eve lived however many years. I don't know, 700 years, whatever it was. How long was she capable of having children? I don't know. 250 years. I don't know. How many children did she have? I don't know. 70. We'll say she had 70. Now, by the time Eve is 500 years old, her first child is, let's say her first child is now 400 years old. And that child, let's say that child also had 70. And her second child had 65. Her third, you know, so within three generations, in principle, you could have 100,000 people easily. I mean, easily. I don't know that's what happened, but I'm just saying, who did Cain marry? I don't know, maybe his fourth cousin three times removed or something like that. I don't know. Not sure. But this is speculation. This is just speculation. My speculation is when Adam and Eve were created, they were genetically more perfect, I guess, if you will. Mutations have happened to bring in all kinds of genetic diseases over time, obviously. And mutations that some people have darker skin, lighter skin, blue eyes, you know, et cetera, these things. All right, so I believe that it would have been perfectly safe for a brother and a sister to marry. That's kind of gross. But, I mean, there's nothing wrong theologically for a brother to marry a sister, although according to our culture, but it's not safe. We're going to talk about the Leviticus and all these laws which had great, awesome, amazing health implications, which might explain why the Jews kept coming back no matter what you try to do to them. And it just so happens this law that says don't marry your sister, your brother, or your cousin, all right, that has wonderful health implications, but I don't think that's a theological thing, not even a doctrinal thing. So if you want to marry your sister, I don't think you're breaking any rules in the Bible. You're breaking the law. And besides, I think it's very, very unwise. Because you have a very high probability of having a genetic disease, so don't do it. All right? Oh, wait, I didn't give the second theory. All right? Another possibility is that there were other evolved, very intelligent primates who did not have a soul or a spirit or a conscience or any of that stuff. Because what makes us different from chimpanzees is not fingers that work differently, less hair and smaller jaws or something like that. What makes us different from chimpanzees is that we're made in God's image. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility that God took an evolved primate named Adam, and evolved primate named Eve, and gave that being a soul and a spirit. I don't think that's I don't think that's what happened, because to me that sounds like I'm just trying to match up the science with, and there's no reason to. I mean, so it's possible that there was interbreeding between those who didn't have a soul and a spirit and those who did, but the natural children of those were in the image of God. And those who were not in the image of God disappeared over time. I believe the former. I believe the former, that Adam and Eve were created by God ex nihilo, to use the very fancy thing. In other words, you know, I already said God could make children of Abraham out of stones. We know that. He can make wine out of water. He can make fish out of nothing. All right, so that's what I believe. But either way, it makes sense that, you know, who Cain could have married and all that sort of stuff.
And either one is consistent
with... It's consistent with the evidence. Either way, it's consistent with the evidence from science, from the Bible, and from everything else we know. I admit I'm reading something in the Bible into it, because I believe the Bible is inspired by God. I've said that several times, right? I keep saying that. I'm viewing it from a biblical perspective, because I know from the evidence that the Bible's inspired. Okay, one more, yeah?
Going back to that, I've heard tales of Eve was actually Adam's second wife, and there was a wife before that named
Lilith. No. Wherever you read that, that's certainly not from the Bible.
Right.
This is from some troublemakers. I don't know who they are. I mean, the Bible is really clear on that, right? The Bible is really, really, really clear on that. Adam married Eve. And they had children. I don't even think that comes from a Jewish document. I don't think so. So who knows where that comes from? You know, the Jews had all kinds of speculations about Enoch and all these other things. And you can read some of those speculations. Some of them might even be remnant information that was traditions handed down from real information. It's possible. There could be information, for example, in First Enoch that's actually true. It could very well be. I don't know. These are kind of fun things to think about. But it doesn't affect Christianity very much. But one thing I'm pretty sure of, that's not from a Jewish source, and it's also certainly not true. All right. Yeah.
I don't know anything about this, so I want to start by saying that.
You don't have to say that. It's okay.
But I heard, like, what do you think about the people who argue that carbon dating is really incorrect for, like, the younger people?
They do that not because of any evidence to support that.
Okay.
They have a presupposition that puts them in. And remember I said don't paint yourself into a corner? These people have painted themselves into a corner, and they're trying to get out by playing games. All right, for example, you go to a young earth creationist, you say, you know that star that's 1 billion light years away? How long did the light leave that star? Everybody knows the answer. So, of course, they won't answer. They say, well, the speed of light has changed over time or something. It's like, there's no evidence for this. This is just kludge. They're just creating a theory with absolutely no evidence whatsoever, only designed to save their belief. Don't do that. Don't do that. Okay? And again, I've said it a few times, I'm going to say it again. It could very well be that God created the earth to appear old. Why he would do that, I don't know, but maybe he did. I know when Jesus made fish, it appeared old. I believe when God made Adam, he appeared old. And I already know that God could do that. The only question is whether he did or not. But please don't try to undermine carbon dating. You know, they'll say, well, there's this example, there was this discrepant thing over there. But sure, there's discrepancies in science all the time. Anyway, that was not to you. That was like to those other people. Yeah, those other people. And again, they've painted themselves into a corner. Actually, it was their preacher who painted them into the corner. They're just trying to get out. All right? Yes.
Okay, I've heard people to kind of allow evolution to make more sense in the creation story to argue that, like, the day that, like, the 7 days that are listed in Genesis, that maybe a day is not what we think of as a 24-hour day.
Right, that's what I said. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are your...
I call that the day-age theory.
Okay.
Yes. The day-age theory. I remember one time... we were just talking with some people, and they were talking about evolution. And my daughter, who was like 10 years old, said, we were talking about the age of evolution. She said, you know, those days in Genesis, they're like, you know, they represent a period of time. And somebody asked her, where'd you get that idea? She said, I was watching Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. So she got that from. All right. But the day age theory, you need a name for it. It's nice to have a name for something. The day age theory. By the way, I skipped the slide. Augustine believed in the day-age theory. Origen believed in the day. These are Christians from the Origins from the 3rd century, Augustine from the 5th century. Philo, the Jewish theologian, most famous Jewish scholar from the 1st century, believed in the day-age theory. The day-age theory was not created. This carbon-14 is unreliable theory. That is directly created from a belief. So some people say, you believe in the day-age theory just because you're a scientist. And no. I mean, long before science was ever created, theologians who knew their Bible and understood a general picture of how the Bible works said this because it seemed clear to them. That Genesis 1 was a theological description given in broad terms what happened and should not be taken as a, you know, chronological, exact, precise scientific description. Okay? Go ahead.
Have you heard of, like, the Creation Museum?
Oh, yeah, it's in San Diego. It's funny. We did a class trip to the Creation Museum. And I said, we're going into the lair of the enemy. And it was funny. They had the kids playing around dinosaurs in these little murals. But it was cool. My students did an awesome job. They were very, very respectful. They asked the guy good questions. They did an excellent job. And then at the end, because this is a secular college, you know, at the end, he shared his testimony, said, you need to pray Jesus into your heart and all that kind of stuff. It's like, oh, I'm going to be in so much trouble. Anyway, nobody complained.
So have you heard at that museum, I heard somewhere where it talked about having even dinosaurs on the ark.
Yeah, but there weren't any dinosaurs in the ark. Dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago. Man, God would have had to create dinosaurs out of nothing to put them on the ark and then kill them later or something like that. I mean, by what theory would dinosaurs be on the ark? I mean, what possible reason would there be to even believe that there might have been dinosaurs on the ark? Because dinosaurs, I mean, if you want to find dinosaur fossils, you have to dig way, 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 way down underneath all those mammals and stuff. They're down there. And it's clear, it is crystal clear there have not been dinosaurs around for a very, very long time. So why would they be on the ark? Okay. By the way, I don't think there were duck-billed platypuses on the ark either. You know, I don't think so. All right? Because how would duck-billed, they're from Australia. I don't know how they would have gotten on the ark. I mean, God could kind of, sort of airlifted them from Australia, put them on the ark, and then after the flood, airlift them back to Australia. I don't think that's what happened. I don't know exactly what happened, but I believe there was an ark. I believe there are animals on the ark. I believe there's a flood. And I believe after the flood, the animals came off the ark. and that Adam and Eve used those animals to get their farm going. All right, the evidence for continental drift or, you know, plate tectonics is very, very strong. Very, very strong. For example, if you go to the bottom of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the rocks at the, right where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is are just, you know, a couple few million years old. Then if you go, let's say, 50 miles out, those rocks are, say, 30 million years old. You go another 200 miles, those rocks are 70 million years old. And you go out, you know, another, then they're 90 million years old. Then you go to the rocks right at the continental shelf in the edge of both Africa and South America, around 120, 130 million years old. Looks like the two separated around 130 million years ago. Now, that's what it looks like. I mean, is that what actually happened? I don't know. But I do know this. We can actually measure the distance from Africa to South America. It can be measured. There's, I'm not kidding. There's a mirror. They put a mirror on the moon. That was not a NASA plot, you know, to say we went there. We actually went there. And you can bounce a laser off the moon. In fact, that's why they put the laser on the moon, so they can measure distances on the Earth. You can measure the distance from South America to Africa to within like a millimeter or so. And they're moving apart at around 1 or 2 millimeters a year. You do the math. You measure the distance. There you go. So, you know, was it one mass? The evidence leads towards this, that there was one. By the way, it wasn't a huge continent because there was much, much, much less land back then than there is now, consistent with what the Bible says. Okay? Yes?
I just want to hear you speak on, like, the Genesis 6, like, the Nephilim idea. And you may have spoke about it.
I don't have much to say about the Nephilim. Read Doug Jackby on the Nephilim. All right? Anyway, the whole, you know, the sons of God had sex with the daughters of man or whatever. You know what I think that means? I think it means guys had sex with women and had babies. I think that's what that's saying. Now, the theory that Doug would at least mention and maybe even support, which agrees with the book of First Enoch for what it's worth, is that angelic beings had sex with women and produce these children who are somehow different than all the others. And that's the actual source of these large people that were around even during the time that the Israelites were entering Canaan. I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of a fun to think about. But I don't know. To me, it looks like people were, you know, men were raping women and doing some terrible things, and it had not a very good result. But, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't know. Doug does a better job on that than I do. And he gives all these sources. And go to his website, type in Nephilim, and you'll get a... If you go to my website, I think I just say, go to Doug's website. I think. Yeah, we'll take a break. Okay.
Because I don't know very much about this. One of the defenses that I've always had is, why don't we stop evolving?
Like, we didn't. We're evolving?
Yeah.
Absolutely, we're evolving.
Like that. Well, I don't know what that means.
Like what?
I don't know how long. Well, if we evolve from, you know, primates, you know, if we came from.
Right, humans.
The period it took to get there, now we're here. We're
definitely evolving. Humans are evolving fairly rapidly.
What do you mean?
There's just so many humans. The more of a species you have, the more evolution can happen. Now, you know, there's some evolutionary differences between you and me, right? Now, by the way, we have far more in common genetically than we have differences. In fact, the amount of differences between African Americans is more than the differences between us, average. So there's clear evidence of evolution, and you can even, it's sort of common sense, the more melatonin in the skin, where there's a lot of sun, prevents skin cancer and a higher survival rate. Another fact is that African Americans are subject to sickle cell anemia, But if you have the recessive genes, the sickle cell anemia, it provides strong protection against malaria. It doesn't prevent getting it, but you generally don't die. That's a mutation, clearly. But if you live in a place with no malaria, that's not so good. That's why that gene is not very common at all amongst whites who live in, you know, et cetera. Evolution's happened. It's happening. Now, I believe the kind of evolution that happens naturally is very, very slow, and I don't believe it can explain the whole tree. I don't believe it can. I believe God has done things. He's not just sort of left it to chance.
And then do you, I mean, so we have one creation. We have one creation.
Yeah. Well, actually, two. We have Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
So, but we have the creation story of